This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a conversation with author Annette McGivney, the author of a book called Pure Land, a true story of three lives, three cultures, and the search for heaven on earth. When I read her book, it hooked me and got me so bad. It was one of those rare books that I could not put down. Hi, Annette.
Hi, Tom.
As you can tell, I'm one of your fans.
Yeah, thank you. And it's a thrill to be here talking to you.
And I must say, you are also a great writer. You have that voice that on the printed page, I can hear you.
Thank you. That really means a lot to me because, as you know, and as an author yourself, writing is a very solitary experience. And so to be able to have someone talk to you about their experience reading your writing is really a gift for me.
It's so fascinating. We're like these little cave people. You have to go into your cave, cut out the entire world, none of the family, nobody can be around, and you're by yourself, and you're crafting these words for communities, for groups, for whole societies, and you're hoping that when it goes back out, that they get it. And you have no clue whether they do or not for maybe ever.
That's right, yeah, and it is for, you know, my book is something like 120,000 words long, and, you know, the whole time I was wondering, is this any good? Are people going to like it? And so yeah, I'm so glad to be at the next stage.
Yeah, and my next stage is in the back of my mind is nobody knows what your book is about because we haven't got that far.
Right.
And then I'm going, well, how do we even, I don't know how you describe your book without reading it. It's so interwoven and permeated into your life and our culture and society. You've done book talk, so go for it.
Pure Land, it sounds complicated, but ultimately it's very simple. It's about how interconnected we all are. So it's a story about how a Native American boy named Randy Weskogami, who was 18.
And this is a true story.
Yes. Yeah. I'm a journalist, so this is very, very true with 30 pages of single-spaced notes at the back documenting everything. But the book is about a murder that happened in Grand Canyon. It's the most brutal murder in the history of Grand Canyon. And it chronicles the lives of the murderer, Randy Weskogami, who was 18 at the time, and a Havasupai Native American youth, and the victim, Tomomi Hanamura, who was from Japan and was hiking down to the reservation where Randy lived in the Grand Canyon. And in the beginning, the book was just, I thought when I started researching, it was just going to be about Randy and Tomomi, but I got sucked in a huge way that I didn't even realize until well beyond the process.
Didn't it start as a magazine assignment?
Yeah, it started as when the murder happened as an article for Backpacker magazine, and I'm the Southwest editor there. So I started researching the murder as a story into is Havasupai, you know, it's a very popular hiking destination. Is it dangerous? Like, what's going on that this woman, Tomomi, was stabbed 29 times? So it was a really horrific murder. And so I started it as a backpacker story. And then when the story was published, there was so much more I wanted to know. And I kept digging in to Tomomi's life and Randy's life. And unknowingly, I was being sucked in down a rabbit hole. And so the third life in the subtitle of the book is me, and about how the three of us are all intertwined in kind of crazy, unimaginable ways.
But even with Tomomi, in that dynamic, you wound up traveling to Japan and staying with the family.
Right. Yeah. Yes. So when I was doing the backpacker story, because the murder case was expected to go to trial, the law enforcement wouldn't give me any personal information on Tomomi or her family. So I wasn't able to interview anyone in her family. But after Randy was sentenced and sent to prison, fortunately, the FBI gave me all the files to the case and helped connect me with Tomomi's family.
And that was one FBI agent, a woman, that you befriended, right?
Right, yes. So there were a couple of people that really helped me on the law enforcement side. So there was the U.S. attorney in Flagstaff, who is also a woman and a Grand Canyon hiker like I am. And And she really encouraged me to research the story because she said, you know, this could have been me or it could have been you down there, you know, because we like to hike alone and like Tomomi was hiking alone. And so she and along with the FBI detective helped connect me to Tomomi's family. And I went to Japan and they didn't speak any English. I didn't speak any Japanese. I didn't know anything about the culture. So fortunately, the FBI Japanese language interpreter went with me. And I also took my son. So I took three people to Japan for 3 weeks. So it was kind of an epic trip. And it was an amazing experience to live in Tomomi's home with her family.
And you really bonded with the family and they with you.
I did, yeah. You know, considering what a culture gap there was, Tomomi's father was like not only Japanese, but old school Japanese. And so he really was from that kind of brand of Japanese culture that was very isolationist. And
that stoicism too. Yeah.
Right. And stoicism, like just kind of not even shedding a tear, but just a stiff upper lip, even though his daughter had been stabbed 29 times. And so he didn't like the West. He wasn't interested in the West at all before Tomomi traveled to the United States. And he sure didn't like the West after she was murdered. And he hadn't given a single interview to any media in Japan or the United States, but he welcomed me and my son. And
what was it? What was the breaker there?
Well, there's a lot of, this is not a woo-woo book, but there are some mystical aspects to this story, that kind of the way the events unfolded and coming from different directions. And so I had written this letter about, you know, how I felt a connection to Tomomi. I wrote a letter to Tomomi's father, and I said, you know, I love Grand Canyon. I hike in the Grand Canyon by myself. I would like to tell Tomomi's story as a woman who also loves the places she loved. And, you know, I didn't think it was going to go anywhere. And I got a letter back from him saying that he had talked to his sister and that the family had decided that they felt Tomomi wanted me to go. And so they were doing it for Tomomi. And that they felt that I was being called on Tomomi's behalf to represent her. And so when I went to Japan, I mean, I was there to get information about her. But kind of crazily, I was also there to help them understand Tomomi because they were asking me about Grand Canyon and all the places in the West where she had visited. And I was able to tell them about those places. Even the most basic things like, you know, they said, how could you be alone in the Grand Canyon? It's so popular. And I'm like, well, it's very big. And and it's definitely possible to be alone on the trail.
Well, and again, where she went, down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. Yeah.
Right. It's an 8-mile hike. And it is a popular destination where she was, but she happened to be alone on the trail at the time. And yeah, and so being in Japan, because they felt like they were honoring Tomomi by having me there, we got the red carpet treatment. Like they, you know, took us to their ancestral village in southern Japan, and I visited Tomomi's grave, and we went to a lot of cultural sites and samurai houses, and I literally slept in Tomomi's bedroom in her apartment.
So even though you never met her, you know her.
From the time I first got the news in the newspaper that there was a hiker missing down in Supai, you know, before her body had been found, I immediately got a sense of her and felt a connection in a way I've never felt a connection with any story, any person I've ever written about. Usually journalists kind of keep a, you know, arm's length distance from their subjects just to remain objective. And I was objective with my backpacker story, but I just felt like I knew her. And that feeling just kept increasing. And so and in Japan, her father gave me her journal, her travel journal. And, you know, they're her most intimate, personal writing about what she's feeling. And there I was reading it. She'd written it in English. And so I had this kind of intimate connection with her. And I still feel really tied to her.
Yeah, no kidding. Then there's the punch. And in your book, it's the story of three lives. You touched on the murderer, you touched on the victim, and you got just punched in the middle about your own life journey. Talk to us about that.
Okay, yes. So it was like a sucker punch. I thought I was just being the kind of, persistent journalist, digging deeper and deeper into the story of Randy and getting all the investigative files and
And
going.
stoicism
Yeah,
again.
right. I am definitely have my share of stoicism and getting to know Tomomi and really digging into her family and retracing her path. And every step along the way, there was like this big fortress in my mind that was crumbling, and I didn't realize it until the whole thing came down. And so subconsciously, all the sadness and violence that I was uncovering about Tomomi and Randy especially, with the violence that he experienced, the dysfunctional home life that Tomomi grew up in, was stirring up memories of my own in my subconscious that I had like basically devoted my whole adult life to keeping under wraps, that I was doing everything in my power to make sure I didn't remember these traumatic experiences from childhood, but I was triggering them subconsciously
Or they were
by
being triggered,
they
yeah.
were being triggered by, like, the more I learned about Randy and the violence that he experienced as a child.
Yeah, I need to divert for a moment because that's your book, man. We're going back and forth.
Right.
Yeah. You know Randy. You spent time with him. You got an entree in prison to spend a lot of time with him.
Right. So I think one thing that might creep people out about this book is and it cre it like was alarming to me is the more I got to know Randy, I mean, I was terrified at the thought of what he had done to Tomomi, but there was also the more I learned about his childhood, I felt like I had stuff in common with him, and I felt
Because he was
compassion.
a victim.
Yes, he was a victim. He was brutally beaten as a child. His father would go into rages and beat him. His mother was an alcoholic and was very dysfunctional and not present in his life. And Randy grew up in a really rough home. And yeah, and so, I felt like his father, he was abusive, but he also had kept meticulous records of Randy's school days and had all these notes from teachers, and I would see, and I he also had meticulous records on how he and his wife, Randy's mother, were going through a divorce, and they had all these fights in court, and I could see that, like, on the days when they were having some big public fight or in court or something was going on, that Randy was also acting up in school, and I felt so sad for Randy, for the child Randy.
Wow. So then we go to your family and your dad, a physician in Texas. Yeah, perceived as a pillar of the community.
Right. So, yeah, so what could I possibly have in common with an 18-year-old Native American kid that lives at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and here I am, 30 years older than he is, and grew up in a upper middle class white suburb in East Texas, and my father was a doctor, my mother was a psychologist. But the thing is, the brutal behavior that Randy experienced as a child, I also experienced. And I also, like, the things that Randy issues he had in school, like he didn't do well in school, he got in fights. I mean, I'm a journalist now, I'm a journalism professor, but I failed first grade. And I could not learn how to read. I got into fights all the time when I was a little kid. I mean, I had a lot of behavior issues, and that was a direct result of how I was being treated, being abused. I was told I had learning disabilities, but what I really had was I was a victim of child abuse. Everyone was saying Randy has these behavior issues when he was a little kid. He has these problems. He's not doing well in school. And I could see exactly why, because of what was going on in his home life. And no one was looking at that. They were only pointing the finger at Randy and saying he had problems.
So we've just intimated and alluded to your family life and how your dad treated you. If you don't mind, open up and
Oh,
dig a little
sure.
deeper.
Yep. Okay. So my family, I have two sisters, an older sister who's 5 years older, and then a younger sister who's 2.5 years younger. There were three of us, and then my dad, like I said, was a doctor. Very gregarious and well liked and
Charming.
yes, charming, very active in the Catholic Church. We were very, religious and my mom
And mass was a regular
Oh yes,
there.
right. I know. If you grew up Catholic, it was like we went to church every Sunday and we went to confession once a month or whatever, and we went to every single holy day and the whole deal. And it was super serious. It wasn't a compassionate brand of Catholicism. It seemed pretty like rules oriented. And if you do not follow these rules, you will suffer the wrath.
There's some guilt there, huh?
Right. And so, yeah. And then, so my dad, even though he would be charming and happy and full of ideas and
He was a dreamer,
he
wasn't
was a dreamer. Yeah. He had all these big goals and to write books and he did get through medical school and he had lots of stories. Like he would tell these like amazing stories. So that was the positive side of my dad. But there was a very dark flip side, and he on just in a split second could change his mood to go from happy to just fly into a rage, and he would start yelling and throw things and basically become insane. He would get so angry that he would kind of lose his sense of reality. And the thing in our family, the roles that we all had, I was on the receiving end of his rage. Like I was the one that was made to feel like I provoked him.
And this is much more so than your sister.
Oh, right. And so I was, the thing is my older sister would run and hide because she
She was smarter.
she always never understood what my she thought I actually had like learning. She thought I had some type of mental deficits because she thought, why in her right mind would she not hide also? And my younger sister would cry and run away, and my mom would get her away when my dad would fly into a rage. But I just remember feeling so infuriated that my dad was a bully and no one would stand up to him. And I felt like I was like a 50-pound little girl, but and my dad was 6'2", but I was like, I'm gonna stand up to you. Like I'm
You were
not gonna
stubborn.
I mean, I didn't feel like what he was doing was right, and I didn't like the way he was bullying our family.
But
And
even when you were physically beaten, you just
right,
stood your ground.
that's right. I did. This is so, yeah, for about my mom, she had chronic depression. Because anyone listening might be wondering, why, where was your mother, and why didn't she stop it? She was more than 50 pounds, but my mom was so chronically depressed that she would like be in her bed and like bedridden, and she would basically hide in her own way. So it was just me and my dad, and I would have these episodes like almost on a nightly basis where my dad would start spanking me for some infraction, something. I let the dog in and the dog is supposed to stay outside or whatever. And the thing that was supposed to happen in his mind was that he would spank me with his belt and then I would cry and it would be over. But my whole conviction, like I guess I feel like looking back now, the only thing I could control in that situation was that I could not cry. So I refused to cry, and that would make him mad. And he would hit me harder, and I would not cry, and I don't remember ever crying. I like would just let him do it, and I was not going to let him win. And he would get so infuriated that he would just kind of just become unhinged and almost like unaware of what he was doing, it seemed. And periodically, my mom would come out, and this is like later when I was having flashbacks and remembering this stuff
A
that
lot
I.
of this stuff did you bury and just kind
Oh,
of
yeah.
totally just not go there?
Oh, I had to bury it because they're, well, for one thing, sometimes when it was really bad and my dad kept going on, my mom would come out of the bedroom and scream at him to stop. Although she would never physically intervene, she would scream at him to stop. And I remember once or maybe twice where she yelled, "You're going to kill her." And if you can imagine how terrifying that would be for a kid. And I definitely remember looking over at her and thinking, what? You know, like, you are not going to, like, stop this. And so those memories to a child, and I would later learn this through my own research into childhood trauma, is when a child experiences something so terrifying and, you know, they don't have the capacities to process it. Mm-hmm. And if there's no adult or, you know, older person to kind of walk the kid through, like, that was crazy. Come over here. Let me give you a hug. You know, are you all right? And what would happen instead for me is finally it would be over and I would be sent to my bedroom and no one would ever talk about it again. Wow. Like the next,
like it never happened.
Yeah. I mean, there were times even when I was kept home from school because, like, they would say that I was sick or whatever. And I don't know, like, you know, at what level things had happened where I was being, had to stay home from, you know, school, but no one, not ever in my entire childhood did either of my parents ever bring it up at all about what my dad did to me. And so children, you know, what does a child do in their, you know, kind of limited capacities is they think, well, I'll just pretend like it didn't happen also, if that's what I'm being modeled for me. So I pretended like it didn't happen. And in order to do that, you just lock it away in your subconscious and don't think about it. Mm-hmm. But the thing is it's not gone. Right. It's there and it's festering and it increases its energy. It doesn't decrease. It doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. Like for
but you thought it yeah. had been the tiger right. had been caged.
Right. And my older sister periodically as an adult, she'd say, "Doesn't it bother you what happened when you were a kid?" And I would always say, "I don't remember it." And I was aggressively trying to not remember it. Mm-hmm. And you know, consciously I was trying to not remember it, but subconsciously Freud, if he was here in this room with us right now, would say subconsciously I was trying to remember it, that I was trying to put myself back in these violent situations to understand, you know, the, like, why my dad acted the way he did. I mean, consciously I thought I am trying to figure out why Randy murdered Tomomi, but subconsciously I feel like I was trying to figure out why my father beat me.
But consciously, you didn't know that.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Right. So that was the big surprise for me. It was quite the shock.
Because it literally was a shock. It snuck up and bit you and knocked you out.
It did. It did. I mean, looking back, I'm like, why didn't I sort of see things starting to crumble? Mm-hmm. And I chronicle this in the book. You know, like my hand, I had weird things happen. Like my handwriting got really shaky. It looked like, you know, like I was a 90-year-old woman or something. My handwriting was weird, and my vision got blurry. Even my I could. And then the kind of the final thing that pushed me over the cliff was I started not being able to sleep.
You thought you were having a heart attack.
Yeah, there were right. I also had heart palpitations, and so I had I thought I was having a heart attack, you know, or that I had some type of heart issue, and so I went to a cardiologist, you know, all this. I mean, I was diagnosed years before being diagnosed with PTSD. I was diagnosed with anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. And you know, I feel like that's sort of, for anyone who is diagnosed with anxiety disorder, I would say, you know, like, you might want to look a little deeper than that, because lots of times there's something that's causing you to be anxious beyond just that you're busy.
Right.
And so I had, like, I stopped sleeping. I went for 10 days without sleeping, and that's what caused the, you know, I was having nightmares, and I thought I was having nightmares about Randy, and I was reliving the murder, but it was actually, I was having flashbacks in my dreams about my dad, and then I started having flashbacks during the day. Mm-hmm. So it was...
So you basically had a breakdown.
I did. It was like, just like, if, you know, in the movies, people see, like, you know, a war veteran, you know, and all of a sudden, like, he's in a shopping mall and there's a, like, a little explosion and it just, he just goes over the edge, you know, and it's like full blown PTSD breakdown. And that's what happened to me.
Yeah. So what happened? You were in pretty intensive therapy, right?
Right. So I, you know, I was terrified, not only at what I was remembering, but that I had, was no longer in control of my mind, which was very, for someone who.
And this isn't kind of, sort of, this is literal.
I'm not exaggerating. Yeah. Like I, for someone who grew as an adult, prided myself on being in total control of my, you know, physically, I could kind of achieve anything I strove to achieve. Mentally, you know, I was always, I felt like I was in complete control, which is obviously an illusion for all of us. But I thought that. And then all of a sudden, I had no control over my mind. It was doing things, you know, I was having all these mental experiences, but it was also doing things to my body. So all the hormones, the adrenaline and the cortisol and all that was just like shooting through my body and causing all types of physical symptoms. And so I had to, first of all, I ended up in a psychiatrist's office in a crisis. Mm-hmm. So it was a crisis psychiatric thing. And so
did you turn yourself in? Did you go there?
Well, I originally just went to my general practitioner that, you know, I went to when I had a sore throat and stuff. And I was in her office and I just started crying and I couldn't stop crying. And I told her I hadn't been able to sleep and all this. She's like, I cannot help you. Like, you've got to go to a psychiatrist. Like, this is you have a psychiatric emergency. And I was like, well, okay. All right. Wow. And, you know, because my mom had been so mentally ill as a child, you know, I always kind of feared, like, I didn't want to have a nervous breakdown like she had. But then there I was having what people think of as a nervous breakdown. Mm-hmm. And so I went to this crisis center and the first thing they asked me, which I'd never been asked, and even if I had have been asked, I might not have answered honestly, but I was just so like broken at that time. So the psychiatrist, the first thing he asked me was, were you abused as a child? And I said, yes. And when I said yes, I mean, things had been kind of seeping in memories, but when I said yes, it just like exploded in terms of everything that started coming back to me, and I had opened the door for all of it. And so, of course, in our culture, you know, the way we treat psychiatric things is to give people like a bucket full of prescription medication. So I walked out of there with like 5 different prescriptions. And that was terrifying also because my mom was addicted to Valium growing up and she was always medicated. And I my dad was a doctor and I have a really hard time trusting doctors because, you know, I felt like my dad didn't have the best interests of my mom or any of us in mind. And, you know, I just have a hard time with that. And so there I was given all this medication and he also, the psychiatrist said, you know, you better get therapy or you're going to get addicted to this stuff. And I knew, you know, it was like a sedative Klonopin, which is benzo, whatever, type of medication. And so I, was on that. I was only on that for like 2 months or something. And then I tapered off of it, but yeah. So as I was on this medication and over a period of a couple of years, slowly ramping off the medication, I did a lot of therapy, a lot of body-based trauma therapy and talk therapy. And I also kind of found my own version of spirituality that was not the Catholic type, but I had to find a strength in a power that was greater than me because obviously I wasn't up to the challenge.
Wow. And so as this was going on, are you also, you're still trying to write the book?
Well, yeah. So, okay.
I mean, there was an intermezzo period.
Right.
There.
Right. Yeah. Right. So originally when my former self was pursuing this project, it was just kind of the typical journalist thing where I was writing a book about a murder of two, and I was writing about two people. And then all of a sudden, I had this major breakdown, and I felt terrified of the book. Like, I set it aside. I felt like the book is what brought me
So he
to
was a
my knees.
monster in a way,
Yeah, it
right?
was toxic. It was, yeah, I thought, wow, like, look what happened with this, book. And I was kind of afraid of it. But alternately, I continued to feel really connected to Tomomi and kept thinking about her. I mean, I'd be doing trauma therapy and stuff, and I would kind of get visions of her driving across Monument Valley or hiking somewhere. And I would just, she was kind of remained very present for me. And so
She was with you.
she was with me. I felt like she was with me. She's still with me, I feel like. And she, so kind of to feel closer to her, I'd look at her journal, like, often I would like kind of just muse through her journal, and I would think about, what would Tomomi do in this situation? And I wonder if Tomomi even knows that this is happening to me. And I would think about her. And so after a couple of years, I started writing essays about my experience with trauma and childhood trauma. And I got some pretty good response from those essays that were published. And friends said to me, "Have you thought about putting yourself in this story?" And in the beginning, that was really like I didn't like embrace that idea at all, because as a journalist, you kind of always write about other people. You don't write about yourself. Like, you're not
You
the
try to,
story.
keep yourself out of it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That's not, it's kind of frowned upon in journalism. And so I thought, oh, I don't know. And so, but I started to put myself in a little bit into the book, and then shared it with friends, and they're like, "This is good, but we need more of you." And I kept putting more and more until people said, "All right, that's enough. Like, you did it." And so, I still, I never set out to write about myself, and I still like, I don't think I'm gonna like write another book about myself. Like, this is probably the first and the last.
Well, humongously
Yeah.
cathartic.
Right. Yeah, but I feel like, I guess this story, the way this story was meant to be, was that I'm kind of like a vessel for telling it, and in order for people to make that connection, they need to know about my story too. And it, in some ways, like
But
it,
like you
yeah.
said, you're intertwined with the two other people in
Right,
the book.
right,
They're
right.
not separate stories.
Right, right. And so I feel like, I feel good about it, and I especially feel good about talking about my own childhood trauma, like when I do events and meet people, and readers contact me, and so many people have come forward because of my story, saying, "I experienced this too as a child, and what you have written has really helped me." And so that for me, that's the whole reason behind it. Yeah.
Wow. And again, your deft ability to weave in and out. You're talking about Tomomi and you're talking about Randy, and then all of a sudden it's about you and then back. What an art. That's a tough dance to do,
Yeah.
and you did it deftly.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, this book took 10 years. So from the time I first started working on it with the backpacker story to when the time it came out was 10 years. And people say, "So you spent 10 years writing this book?" And it's like, no, I spent 6 months writing this book. I spent 9.5 years
Living it.
right, living it and contemplating the structure. I mean, I had four previous versions of the outline and how it should work and the flow,
Did you actually kind of graph it out?
yeah, I did. I had it like maps, maps of how it would go, and ultimately I kind of came down with the braided structure, and which is good that I'm in it, because you can't braid two threads, you need three. And so it's this braided structure, and I guess, I mean, I've had a few people find it annoying because they want to just stick with
With one,
the predictable,
Well,
formulaic,
they're definitely not ADD then.
yeah, right. And but otherwise, I feel like it's, like we were talking about before. When I was writing it, I was like, I have no idea if this is going to work or not, but it seems to be working for me. So
Well,
yeah.
and like I said, in my own brain, I typically read 3 to 5 books at once,
Yeah.
but you got me so
Yeah.
bad that became my sole mission, and it worked well for my brain, again, for that exact reason, because that's how I work.
Yeah. Right, right, yeah, and so, and I just feel like, you know, you needed to have time just with Randy, and then time just with Tomomi, and time just with me, and there, but there are moments in the book where we cross, and there's like, you know, maybe 5 or 7% of the book where like the paths cross, and like that's some powerful moments.
Okay, so one question is it optioned for a movie yet, and if not, why not?
Well, I can answer the first question, which we are trying, my publisher and I are trying to get it out there, an option for a movie, but at this point we have not found anyone. I have a small publisher, so I don't have like kind of the big powerhouse, you know, Simon and Schuster kind of like, so so it's tougher with a small publisher. One big agency did look at it, and the person with that agency that reviewed it said that she can only take one project a year or something, and that she loved the story, but she kind of was obligated to go with something more commercial.
Well, forget her. We're moving on. Because, I mean, I know you see it graphically and visually, the power of it.
Yeah.
I see it being a literal blockbuster, just, you know, on the edge of your seat, as I am now.
I agree, and I feel like, you know,
agents out there, listen.
Yeah, especially anyone with HBO or who's interested in a 5-part series.
Yeah.
I feel like I, you know, like the Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks was made into a 5-part HBO series. Like, you know, in that type of thing, it could have the space to really let each of the three characters be developed.
Oh, yeah. No, no kidding. Wow.
Yeah.
So needless to say, buy the book, Pure Land. Before we go, this is way out there, and I know, I mean, you lived it, your mom in the gas mask.
Right. Right. So we're talking about cinematic moments.
Yeah. That is, you can't make that stuff up.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So that, I had some crazy experiences as a child, and I'm sure a lot of people that had like mentally unhealthy parents also have had this, but maybe not with a gas mask. And so my mom was a hypochondriac and obsessed with allergies, and she felt like she was getting chemical poisoning from the air in East Texas. And she, this was like not long after the Vietnam War ended, and so there was a bounty of gas, those really
Army surplus and readily available.
Yeah, like we're not talking about a like a paint filter. We're talking about the big metal triple filter.
Canisters.
And she would strap that thing on and drive us to school, drive us around town with a gas mask on. We had this big green station wagon, and she'd be behind the wheel with the gas mask and pull up in front of the school, and we'd have to get out of the car, and she had the gas mask on, and so it was I mean,
you can't
make
that stuff up.
I have very thick skin.
If this does become part of your movie, I can just hear the critics going, whoa, that's not plausible, you know.
No, it definitely happened. And I've got my sisters to vouch for that.
Unbelievable. Well, all I can say is buy the book Pure Land, a true story of three lives, three cultures, and the search for heaven on earth by Annette McGivney. Wow.
Thanks, Tom.
Oh, yeah. You touched my life.
Oh, I appreciate it. And yeah, if I can also just plug, I have a nonprofit. It's called the Healing Lands Project. And because I dig into issues around domestic violence and how that affects children, I started a nonprofit that raises funds to take children on wilderness river trips. And so kids in the Arizona foster care system are taken on river trips through profits from my book. So when people buy the book, it helps the nonprofit. And we also have a website, which is iampureland.com, that accepts donations online.
Spill it out.
iampureland.com.
Nice. Annette, again, you touched my life. You touched my heart.
Thank you so much, Tom. I'm really grateful for you to be able to talk about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, wow.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org. And whether you're shopping for new or used items, donating them, or volunteering, you're helping the Society of St. Vincent de Paul help others.